Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In his latest novel, poet and novelist Alan Michael Parker tells the story of 10 people who meet and encounter a 13-year-old girl living with cancer in her final days. Now, at first glance, that, the author admits, sounds like the making of a Hallmark special. But in Parker's hands, the book Christmas in July is anything but. 13-year-old Beatrice Danzig changes her name to Christmas and is an angry, opinionated, sarcastic, mean, and occasionally wise adolescence. In many ways, a typical teenager, but she's dying of cancer. Her father has died, her mother's unable to care for, so she's living in a strange town with an aunt who's a stranger to her. Christmas in July tells her story through 10 very quirky and eccentric characters in this new town she encounters. Some are hilarious, others poignant, others are just mysterious, this relationship. The characters' encounters with Christmas range from ephemeral to profound, as we gradually learn more and more about Christmas through their own stories. Alan Michael Parker is a professor of English at Davidson College. Christmas in July is his fourth novel, along with 8 collections of poetry and a 9th forthcoming. He's won 3 Pushcart Prizes, and 2 of his poems have been included in the Best American Poetry Anthology. He was a guest of the University of Tulsa Creative Writing Department last week, and I spoke with him while he was here. Alan Michael Parker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Christmas in July is a novel, but it's a set of 10 stories with 10 narrators, all of which who have encountered Beatrice Danzig, or as she goes by, Christmas.
Right.
She's changed her name, a 13-year-old who has cancer. And they're all very quirky, interesting narrators that tell of their oftentimes very brief encounters with Christmas. So what was the origin of this book? Was it a story, an individual story from this collection, or was it the concept?
I think there are 2 origin stories. They probably compete for truthfulness, as is my wont. But one is that I had worked prior to writing this book on a project that I had written for about 9 straight months where I was writing every day. And as I often do when I'm early on in a project, I was going to a word count. So I'm not Malcolm Cowley writing 2,000 words a day, but I was writing 250. And I had to do my 250 every day. And it's a project that unusually so for me, I abandoned. I almost never give stuff up. And it had taken too many turns. A page and a half of that ends up in Christmas. So maybe Christmas is a rewrite. It's a revision of that novel. Maybe I can make that claim. But there is a page and a half that survives. So in that sense, there's some origin there.
So maybe explain that concept of writing 250 words. I would think that's that seems like a small number.
It is. But
but it's almost like combining your other love, poetry, and prose.
That's true, and the economics of it are a challenge because you have to it's the minimum, and there were some days where it was 1,500. So there are some days where I'd write 6 pages, and this is all just to generate a draft, just to get on the page, to propel a story forward. After which, my working method is then to storyboard and outline and make a book out of whatever it is that I have managed to gush about for that period of 9 months or a year. The 250 is manageable in a work day. That was the big advantage, that I could do it in an hour. Sometimes I could do it in 20 minutes. One of the things you learn when you're trying to do 250 is that dialogue is actually, there are so few words in dialogue that it ends up being more pages, which becomes a little trick I play with myself to try to write more dialogue because I know it's a little harder. But it's a good combination of the trying to make sure that my prose matters at the level of the essential word by word movement through a sentence, but also combining that with larger ambitions, which is to write a novel.
So this project didn't work out.
Didn't work out.
But there was a page and a half that apparently caught your eye. What was it about that page and a half?
Well, it's a page and a half that in the second story in Christmas in July, one of the characters encounters a group of people who are living in the woods, and she is a runaway, and they may or may not be part of a cult. And it's
the Farleys.
It's the Farleys. So it's the Farley song. So uh-huh. The song sung by the Farleys is, in fact, what survives.
And I would say they were cult.
I would say they are. I'm trying not to give.
I understand. No, we won't give any spoilers. But they are a cult.
They are a cult, and they have
they have some really interesting rules.
They have some really interesting rules, and some of it has to do with social performance of their of what may or may not be religious inclinations on their part. But they are a cult.
But the Farley is all about whether the Farley is actually going to arrive. There's a little bit of waiting for Godot.
Yes. Yes. And in the interim, they are behaving badly amongst themselves.
Yes.
But yes. Yeah. And Godot is dear to me, too. So I appreciate that.
So reference. Out of that page and a half that you decided to save, how did this book come about?
Well,
so
there
what's
was
the second story.
So the second story is that I was writing a short story thinking, I probably do want to be writing another novel. Following at that moment, I had some time in terms of I could see the arc of my schedule, and I was writing a short story, and it kept on being interrupted by a teenage girl, and so she arrived in this story, and she kept on insisting on interrupting what I was trying to do.
What was the story?
Oh my gosh! So it was there were two characters, and it was a brother and a sister. I'm trying to remember. I mean, it's lost in its way.
Yeah, the book is morphed.
It's 4 years ago. Yeah. So they didn't survive. They're on the cutting room floor, but she kept interrupting, and I thought, well, who is this person? She's a teenager, but she's exceptionally angry and candid. And so, under what narrative circumstances would a 13-year-old girl have that response to the world? And so that led to my thinking about what it would be like were she sick. And then I test drove a dramatic monologue in her voice, because the voice is crucial, as you've noted, that the novel is composed of 10 different first person stories. And I do believe that the syntax does, for us, perform the consciousness of the character. Dialogue allows us to see the gaps between the character's expectations and desires. All sorts of things are happening in language that are voice specific. So I had to hear her voice, and I think that probably is the true origin of the novel, that Christmas herself arrived vocally.
Of course, we never hear that voice in the novel, because we hear the novel. We hear the voices interpreted by these 10 characters,
and that was a huge formal problem for the writing of the book. So, do I want to give her a Molly Bloom-esque soliloquy at the end? Do I want to? And what are the politics of having a protagonist who in a novel that's a roundtable of voices, that's a colloquy, and not empower her? So does she lack agency if I'm shutting her up? So there was a real tussle there for me in the writing about what I was going to do, how I was going to handle her. And I felt at a certain point that if I'd done my job right in this book, that the prestidigitation is sufficient, that you see Christmas over the arc of the novel and her decline and her increasingly feral behavior, wandering this small town, the people she's meeting. But really what you see are the 10 characters. And I think it's their novel while you're watching her go.
Yeah. And, of course, that anger that's so a part of it is, well, you know, a 13-year-old facing raging hormones.
Yeah.
At the same time facing her own mortality, too.
Yeah. And what that lets me do is it's a kind of can opener in terms of her experiences with other people, because she has nothing to lose. It's lost. She, for various plot circumstances, has been well nigh orphaned. She's under the care of a guardian, and I think, as one of the characters notes, that she's wandering this town she doesn't know, and she's looking for a porch to crawl under and die.
Was a really wonderful, you know, that was really well written, that little
I appreciate that
little piece.
Thank you.
Because it really was, even though you didn't realize it at the time, and it was sort of like that that line was sort of an epiphany.
Yeah, it was for me as well. And the word feral was very important, that there was a sense that she was returning to some kind of behaviors that were wild, but also, have that, has that etymological power of the ferocious, that something is happening there as well.
We really don't know her circumstances till the very end of the book, too.
Right.
And that you keep that a mystery to us. In fact, the first story, we meet Angela, a middle-aged registrar at, Saxon Hills Middle School.
Yeah.
Who is dealing with her own issues. And this is the whole thing, is all these characters have their own issues, and their encounters with Christmas are sometimes peripheral.
Sometimes there are stories in which she has no lines. She has a walk-on.
Yeah.
And there's a story in which we meet her, we see underneath the bathroom stall and there's her shoe, and there are a couple of exchanges and she's crying, but that's all. There's a story in which there's a ghost story. We don't know actually if she is the ghost for a portion of that story. And that was of interest to me formally. I mean, with 10 stories and coming out of poetry, my inclination is to think about repetition, expectation, producing the reader's interest as a result of formal management. So I'm interested in the way that the stories might want you to want certain kinds of endings. But I also have to be very careful. It's a novel, and they can't be built the same way. And that led me to bring her on stage through various doors, or sometimes only seen through a window. And I began to think of each of the stories together as a theatrical production of sorts.
In many ways, you're leaving it to the reader to fill in the details for ourselves about her.
Yeah, that's the poet in me. So the previous novel, almost all of the action happens off stage, and by inference and by implication, I believe in the reader's powers, and I want my imagination to activate yours.
And it seems like for a lot of these stories that we're learning about that character, Angela, for example, the registrar. We know it opens with 3 or 4 phone messages from her mother, all talking about her divorce and how, a second marriage, it can be fun, and just the typical mother voice coming through. And then Angela encounters this girl that she thinks her aunt, who is enrolling her, says her name is Beatrice, and she goes, "I'm Christmas."
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, she opens up to Christmas. This is one of the most interesting. I think it's one of the most, it's the opening story, and it's one of the most interesting because she opens up to a total stranger off the bat.
And announces, as soon as they're alone, announces to her, "I'm getting a divorce," for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
But what has happened in part is her kids are out of town. The voicemail and the pressure from her mom, which I've put in the foreground of the story, has led her to a moment where she sees this sick kid and wants to act maternally, but this is not her kid, and then confesses in this kind of blurting moment about what's happening in her own life.
A lot of those characters share that same moment with Christmas.
And I'm hoping to earn that. It's really quite important to me. One of the main projects of this novel from the outset was, how do I write about a 13-year-old girl who's dying? I tell you she's dying. She's dying the whole novel. There's no spoiler. There's no secret. She encounters all these people. Their lives are changed without it becoming a Hallmark card. So how can she change these lives? How can these people be different as a result of encountering her? And maybe not in the most epiphanic way, but just have this human-to-human interaction that they are changed by her. And so often, because of her life circumstance and her candor and the fact that she's 13, people say things to her they would never say to anybody else.
Yeah. And at the same time, she's generally pushing those people away with the anger. I was struck by a line that another character it's the story Meg's team, and
yeah.
Meg O'Daly is the scorekeeper for a softball team that she's been following for years, and she's sort of their adopted grandmother at this particular point. And And she says, any teenage girl named Christmas is bound to be a Hellcat.
Yeah. And Meg knows because Meg's a Hellcat.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, no, that's that story. And she and Meg have a crucial moment because this is in many ways the first story in the novel in which Christmas reaches out to someone else and says thank you. I mean, there's a moment of gratitude in Christmas that we haven't seen. We've just seen her, in a way, be a foil. And then when she encounters Meg and Meg's grandmotherly ministrations, Christmas does respond with, I think, a key emotional moment in the story, in the novel.
Yeah. My guest today is Alan Michael Parker. He's a poet and fiction writer. His latest novel is titled Christmas in July. It's published by DeZank Books. He's a professor of English at Davidson College, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you've written some memorable narrators. One that really caught my eye was Dorothy, who mm-hmm. runs the Dorothy's website.
Yes, DearDorothy.com.
DearDorothy.com. She's apparently a Wizard of Oz trivia buff who began writing this website where people, I guess, pose questions to Dorothy Gale.
They seem to believe that she is Dorothy Gale.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, the comedy in there is that she is a Korean-American film professor living in Los Angeles and whose name is Dorothy and was named after Dorothy by her late mother. But yes, they seem to, for some reason, Dear Dorothy has become Dorothy herself. They say things like, I loved you at the Winter Garden. And she writes back, she says, you know, I'm not, you know, we're both kind of pretending here. I'm not the real Dorothy Gale. But, and they confuse her, you know, with Judy Garland. And that becomes a comic moment throughout that story. But she is very happy to be performing a kind of L.A. screen life for herself. And she sees herself on, you know, some people see themselves, you know, they say, I want you to make a movie of my life. She's in her own movie.
Yeah, she's got her public face.
Yeah.
And the screen is protecting her private self.
Yeah.
Even from a significant person in her life.
Yes, and that the unveiling of that relationship is at the center of the story, where they realize they might actually have something going on, they might not, but whatever is happening, that they're backstage or offstage together for the first time, and there's some, I hope, quite moving emotional moments between them, and especially toward the end of that story.
And of course, Christmas only appears writing a note to her.
Yeah, she's only virtual in that story, and it's the only story that's not set in this fictional town in Western Maryland that I have created. It's set in Los Angeles. It's the only one of the 10.
And what's interesting is you play a joke on the reader because we think we're learning all about Christmas, and yet you're not.
Yeah, then let's hope we call it prestidigitation rather than a joke. Because I don't want you to feel suckered by the book. I'm hopeful mm-hmm. that its machinery is not at the expense of what you want it to be. I mean, there's of course great irony in the title, in the way in which such a celebration, the kinds of feelings that happen with a Christmas in July, the towns that throw those parties. And that she has renamed herself Christmas, and the novel takes place in the month of July, pretty much exclusively. At the same time, there are sadnesses in this book, and not only hers, not only the sadness of a child who's sick, but other people who are encountering other tribulations.
Yeah. I was really taken by the character Snowjo, which I know you've said is perhaps the most eccentric of these very eccentric characters. Snowjo lives up in the woods, and as you mentioned, this feral nature of Christmas, she wanders further afield than this basically a strange town to her that she's been brought to ostensibly die.
Yeah.
She goes out and explores, sometimes days at a time, and her aunt is basically allowing this to happen because she knows, you know,
what's going to happen.
Yeah, no.
It's a small town, right. And the girl's already dying, and the girl needs to be given as much, you know, given her lead in this way. And so the aunt permits it. The aunt is checking up. So the aunt, we get a couple of moments where the aunt is actually phoning around to make sure, you know, so Aunt Nikki says it's okay. Christmas checks in whether she can go back to see Snow Joe. She meets him, so she is in the woods and she's sick, and he and his dog discover her, bring her back to his house. And he is the most eccentric guy. I mean, Meg's out there. There are other people who live in other circumstances. I would say Evie is also quite
unusual.
Evie is
the glitter girl. Who's running a glitter festival, a rock concert sort of.
And who is in a subculture where she's not a furry, but she sprays glitter all over herself and then gets dressed and then has this secret life where she knows she's got glitter spray on her body. But Snow Joe, he is some combination of the semi-Buddhist, semi-American woo-woo, you know, this religious
somebody who probably did way too many drugs at one point
in
his life.
It's possible. Yeah. He's not the guy who featured in an earlier novel whom I call Ponytail Guy.
Yeah.
But he might be his brother. And he makes his own clothes. He has his own theories about the relationship between the environment and our spirituality. He has his own versions of some half yoga, half calisthenics that he does.
He has to do poses.
Yeah.
He makes his living by beekeeping
and
shoveling snow.
So hence he's Snow Joe. And they have, I think because of how eccentric he is, how marginalized he is by choice and also by temperament. It's hard to imagine him functioning, you know, bagging groceries. She recognizes in him a fellow traveler. Yeah. And they have very serious conversations about the nature of death, and about what it means. And she talks to him about her physical pain in ways that she doesn't speak with anyone else.
You see her vulnerability, really. I mean, even when she is sick in other parts of the book, she doesn't allow you to see her vulnerability. And with Snow Joe, she does.
She does.
Yeah. It's a really amazing book. The name of it is Christmas in July. My guest today is Alan Michael Parker, poet and fiction writer and professor of English at Davidson College. Now, I understand, I don't know if music always plays a role when you're writing, but there is a playlist for this book. You created a playlist. What was that all about?
So there's a great website called Large Hearted Boy, and he's been around for a while, this guy who hosts it, who's deeply interested in literature and music, and he asks writers to come up with a playlist and make some comments about the music. So it's either music you were listening to when you wrote the book, or music you associate with, or the characters might be listening to. So mine is a combination of songs that I might associate with, tracks with the characters, but also, and this was the real challenge, trying to imagine the musical tastes of some of my characters and I don't share those tastes. So there are some songs on this playlist. It's online on largeheartedboy.com. And there's some songs that every one of the stories, there are 10 choices. Everyone has a corresponding selection. And I write a little bit about each of the songs. And some of them are, I mean, Meg's, Jackson, I mean, Johnny Cash
and June Carter.
Yeah, although for me, it's the YouTube version, not the album version. So there are songs that I love, but each one.
But that's the most conventional song on the playlist, I will say.
It is the most conventional song on the playlist. The last song on the playlist, which is a song by a now defunct Twin Cities band called Dark, 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 is the song that I most associate with Christmas herself. It's the hardest song by way of its sadness, and in many ways is anthemic for me thinking about the writing of the book. It's a tough song. It's very sad, and a haunting voice, beautiful singer. So a playlist, and I recommend that. I mean, I learned a ton about my characters by trying to think about what songs they would like. It's not a question I usually ask.
Was this something that happened during the writing process or only after the book was put to
bed?
Yeah,
afterwards. Though yeah. I think I could see it as an assignment for my grad students.
Ah.
I could certainly see, okay, now you've written this story. And I will ask students, okay, so what's that character's favorite color? And they say, why? It doesn't go into the story. I said, but you have to know. You can't write this character without knowing that. And I ask, what item in the person's apartment do they own that they stole? And these sort of random questions by way of police blotter building of character development for my students when they're thinking about how to write their people. Because you have to know these things about your people, no matter what genre you're writing in.
This is certainly a character-driven novel. Your earlier novel was also character-driven, but in a very different way.
The previous novel, yeah. So
the Committee on Town Happiness.
Yeah, so the Committee on Town Happiness is much more formally eccentric itself. So it's 99 connected short stories. The whole novel's in the first person plural. And it's narrated.
It's the committee.
It's the committee itself, which is the narrator of the book. And it's a riff on small town politics, academic politics, HOAs, fascism, throwing a party when you see things are bad, the kinds of things that small towns do, parades and especially on regulations and rules.
Yes, a lot of regulations.
So there are lots of codicils and laws and the committee is voting all the time. And it also a small town novel, but in that novel, people who leave the town don't come back, so it has a kind of sci-fi edge to it, and the populace is pretty steadily shrinking, and the committee is worried and trying to figure out what's happening.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's an interesting book because even though it's written in this plural first person, the committee has a character, and it's very character driven. Is that how you tend to write?
Yeah, I really am. I really, at some level, my imagination is a gossip, So I'm interested in how to project and inflect and nose around in the people that I'm working with on the page, and I think that character relationships are at the center of what I do. I mean, I think literature allows us that access to the other in a way that is, I think it's an act of love fundamentally. And I think it's an act of communal restoration, is to help understand what other people are like from the inside. And so as a novelist, that's certainly what I'm up to do.
Well, I notice as far as publishing, you've been publishing prose lately. Is poetry still a big part of your...
Yeah, very much. There's a new collection of poems that'll probably be my next book. It's pretty far along. It's in the hands of my editor. I seem to be moving, alternating between poetry and prose these days. I started writing prose because I had been teaching creative writing and teaching fiction writing, and it made me itchy to do my own. It got to the point where it seemed, it wasn't, okay, if I'm teaching them how to do it, I should do it, which I do believe at some level. Nevertheless, I started writing it because I was teaching it and it made me want to write it. My sentences as a prose writer are directly informed by my work as a poet. And now my sentences, my lines are directly informed by my work as a prose writer.
Alan Michael Parker, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Alan Michael Parker is a professor of English at Davidson College. His new book is titled Christmas in July, published by Zank Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.